just the flu. King's query letter showed up addressed to him, and it was passed on to Thompson, who responded to King. After a long and stellar career, Thompson no longer hangs his shingle at a publishing house. He's an independent editorial consultant helping authors with their book-length manuscripts. For writers of commercial fiction, that's good news. What are the odds that the same editor would discover not one, but two of the best-selling authors of our time? Thompson discovered Stephen King, of course, and also John Grisham. It was hardly luck. A good editor recognizes great talent when he sees it. A lifetime in the book trade as an editor has served him well. On his website, Thompson gives two pieces of advice to whet an aspiring writer's appetite for his editorial services. On premature submissions, he writes, "A lot of new writers make the mistake of sending a manuscript to an agent or publisher before it's actually ready. You may have an interesting storyline, but it doesn't translate into potential sales until it's wrapped up in a full-size, polished, marketable manuscript. Then you have something to offer." In other words, you don't get a second chance to make a first impression, so make it count by making your manuscript as good as possible. In King's case, Thompson asked for a rewrite on the last quarter of Carrie, which King was happy to do. That the book sold to Doubleday and went on to command a record sale to a paperback house is testimony to the validity of Thompson's acumen. On stories, Thompson offers the following. "If a fiction author knows how to tell a story, I can help him nail down what the story is, help him flesh it out and give dimension to the characters without losing track of the story. With many manuscripts, I also try to bring a cinematic sense, thinking of how it would play as a movie." Thompson started out at the bottom rung of the ladder, selling to independent booksellers. Carrying the bag, as it was called, which meant carrying an overstuffed big bag of advance copies, promo sheets, and other sales literature to pitching books individually, and as quickly as possible to booksellers. His beat was New Orleans and Memphis. He then moved to New York City to begin his career as an editor, where he is properly credited for discovering and nurturing Stephen King. He went on to serve as editor for Everest House, which published King's major nonfiction work, Danse Macabre, and also worked as editor for G.P. Putnam and Arbor House. He finished his editing career at Winwood Press, where he served as editor-in-chief. Though the company is now defunct, it published John Grisham's first novel, A Time to Kill. Grisham's second, more commercial novel, The Firm, catapulted him to fame and fortune. Writers who've been privileged to work with Thompson and to have their manuscripts sharpened and honed to a razor's edge sing his praises. Novelist Kate Wright wrote on his website, "Bill is the perfect kind of editor who can be critical, discerning, precise, and most important of all, encouraging. You can trust him to know what needs to be done to get your manuscript in the best possible shape." Reverend Canon John H. Taylor wrote, "No one knows writing, the arc of a story, the texture of a description, the heartbeat of character, and nobody knows the publishing industry like Bill Thompson. If you have a book in you, he's the one to help you bring it to life." In A Girl Named Carrie, an essay Thompson wrote for Kingdom of Fear, The World of Stephen King, he boiled it all down to this. "Basically, the editorial process means understanding what the author wants to do and helping him get there." He realizes that authors, for all sorts of reasons, can lose sight of the story's objective by getting caught up in the details and failing to see the big picture or the flaws inherent in the structure. Even Stephen King, whose submitted manuscripts usually require little editing, acknowledged that for Carrie, Thompson's editorial input was invaluable. In On Becoming a Brand Name, King wrote, "Thompson's ideas worked so well that it was almost dreamlike. That was my first experience with what editors are supposed to do. I think that on subsequent occasions, Thompson's advice has been good or better, but in that particular case, it was inspired. The book industry is replete with good editors, but Bill is a rara avis, a black swan among white ones. As King and Grisham would tell you, Bill is simply the best. 16. Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King, the future Queen of Durham. The Power to Dream. Parents are supposed to be safety nets for their children. The ideal 1950s nuclear family included a set of parents, a father and mother, who functioned as just such a safety net, but Stephen King's mother, Ruth, had to take up all the slack because the other safety net had a king-sized hole in it. Back in the 1950s, the local, state, and federal governments didn't have an interlocking system of support for single mothers. The support system instead was the extended family, which comprised siblings and grandparents. The more, the merrier. Everything we know about Ruth King we know through Stephen King's interviews, autobiographical pieces in Danse Macabre, afterwards to his stories, notably The Woman in the Room, as well as through one interview with Stephen's brother, David. From Ruth's high school yearbook, we learned that she excelled in public speaking, which won distinction for her in numerous plays and honor for the school in every contest she has entered. Trained as a pianist, she also played the organ on a radio show that was broadcast on the NBC network, recalled Stephen. Lacking a college education, and after her husband left the family, saddled with the responsibility of looking after two children and her own parents, Ruth could never afford the luxury of pursuing her own dreams. She lived and sacrificed for her boys to ensure that they, unlike her, would go on to realize their dreams. She wanted them to have a better chance of succeeding in life by going to college and earning a diploma, a one-way ticket out of Durham, Maine, which held her captive, and to a better life. Stephen King once observed that dreams often die before the dreamer, which unfortunately was true in his mother's case. As King told Mel Allen in an interview published in Bare Bones, Conversations on Terror with Stephen King, she was a very hard-headed person when it came to success. She knew what it was like to be on her own without an education, and she was determined that David and I would go to college. You're not going to punch a time clock all your life, she told us. She always told us that dreams and ambitions can cause bitterness if they're not realized, and she encouraged me to submit my writings. It was all Ruth King could do to make ends meet by working a series of low-paying, blue-collar jobs. In fact, over a 9-year period, Stephen recalled his mother worked as a presser in a laundry, donut maker on the night shift at a bakery, store clerk, housekeeper. From the bakery, she brought home broken cookies for dessert. Like his mother, Stephen shared a talent for public speaking and a love of drama activities, which may help explain why Stephen King can speak with ease extemporaneously at public events. Early on, when Ruth saw Stephen's love of writing, she not only encouraged him, but also gave him money for postage to send the manuscripts off to publishers. And for both her sons, when they were in college, she scrimped up $5 for each on a regular basis so they'd have pocket money. It would only be later that Stephen discovered she skipped meals to come up with the money we so casually accepted. It was very unsettling, he recalled in an interview reprinted in Bare Bones. As for reading material, Ruth enjoyed reading Fate magazine, which purported to publish true stories of the strange unknown, according to its cover. It focused on the paranormal field, which the magazine's current-day website defines as embracing vanished civilizations, communication with spirits, synchronicity, exotic religions, monsters and giants, out-of-place artifacts and phenomena too bizarre for categorization. Science fiction, horror, and the paranormal were all subjects of intense interest to Stephen King, too. When Stephen King was a teenager growing up in Durham, his neighbors thought of him as weird for preferring the company of his imagination instead of playing with his friends outside. But it was a good weird. Ruth encouraged him to dream and write, and as he continued reading and writing popular fiction, he inevitably turned his attention to professional publication. It wasn't clear where Stephen King's writing talent would take him, but it was clear that he had the goods. The big question was what he would do with it. No more broken cookies. As children, we needed to have our dreams encouraged and nurtured. My mother did that for me. Stephen King, dedicating the Milton Academy's Ruth King Theater. In a perfect world, people would get their just desserts, not broken cookies. The Kings didn't live in a perfect world. They lived in a hardscrabble world. For 10 years, he told Playboy, we lived a virtual barter existence, practically never seeing any hard cash. If we needed food, relatives would bring a bag of groceries. If we needed clothes, there'd always be hand-me-downs. So, yeah, I guess in many ways it was a hard scrabble existence, but not an impoverished one in the most important sense of the word. Thanks to my mother, the one thing that was never in short supply, corny as it may sound to say it, was love. In early 1973, King had just sold his first book, Carrie. He was on his way to becoming a professional writer. King, finally, had broken through in a life-changing way. That was when Ruth King knew everything would turn out just fine for her son. It was, she knew, only a matter of time, because he'd keep at it until he reached the level of success he'd strived for. Sadly, Ruth King's days were numbered. The cancer that riddled her body would soon take its inevitable toll. Upon learning this, Stephen and his family moved from Bangor to North Windham, Maine, to be near her. Stephen made sure she got an advanced copy of Carrie. In a short chapter in Lord John's Signatures, 1991, he explained that, I signed my first autograph in late 1973. That autograph read, For Ruth King. Thanks for letting me wonder. I love you, Mom. Stephen King. I haven't the slightest idea what happened to the proof copy. It would be worth a small fortune, I suppose, in the mad atmosphere of today's collector's market, where the autographs of some writers command sums of money which seem, to me at least, surreal. In On Writing, Stephen King recalled her last moments. My boys, she said. A shadow of her former self, Ruth was 90 pounds, down from her normal weight of 160. On December 18, 1973, at 7:15 a.m., Nellie Ruth Pillsbury King passed away. She was only 60 years old. She was a wonderful lady, Stephen recalled to Playboy. A very brave lady in that old-fashioned sense, and went to work to support us, generally at menial jobs because of her lack of any professional training. After my father did his moonlight flit, she became a rolling stone, following the jobs around the country. She worked as a laundry presser and a donut maker, like my wife 20 years later, as a housekeeper, a store clerk. You name it, she did it. Stephen King later told Mel Allen in an interview, Ah, if my mother had lived, she'd have been the Queen of Durham by now. If only. Ruth P. King Obituary. The Lewiston Daily Sun, December 19, 1973. Durham. Mrs. Ruth P. King, 60, a resident of Methodist Corner, died Tuesday at the home of her son, David, in Mexico, Maine. She was born in Scarborough, February 3, 1913, the daughter of Guy H. and Nellie Fogg Pillsbury. She was educated in schools of Scarborough and the New England Conservatory of Boston, Massachusetts. She was a retired worker from the housekeeping department at the Pineland Hospital. She was a member of the First Congregational Church of Durham. Surviving are two sons, Davy V. of Mexico and Stephen E. of North Windham. Three sisters, Mrs. Mary Donahue, Durham, Mrs. Lois Story, Scituate, Massachusetts, and Mrs. Ethelyn P. Flaws, Durham. Paying It Forward. After King became successful, he told David Pettis during an interview in Fan Plus that he had no love for his father, but loved his mother. When asked, "Do you ever wish they could see you now?" King responded, "Sure. I mean, my father I could care less about. But I wish my mother could see me now. It would be great. She worked very hard all her life for us, and I'd like to give her all the nice things I could give her now. I always think of her when something good happens to me. I think, gee, I gotta call my mother and tell her. And then I say, shit, she's dead. It's really a nasty trick for things to have turned out that way. But it leaves me, as her son, in a position of not being able to pay back anything." Stephen and Tabitha King do what others in their position have done. They pay it forward. Their generosity, through foundations they've established, and especially to the Bangor community, speaks volumes about their character. The Kings know what it's like to not have money. So they donate money to pay for critically needed heating oil for indigent families and donate to other worthy causes. That's how the Kings were raised. Their parents taught them well. 17. Carrie, 1974. I remember once years ago seeing the author of The Third World War on a TV chat show in England. And when the interviewer asked John Hackett about his book, the first thing he said was, "Oh yes, it's just some old trash I put together." I do think of Carrie that way. Stephen King, Publishers Weekly, January 24, 1991. Harlan Ellison, looking back at some of the big mistakes in his life, pondered why he had committed them and came up with an explanation. It seemed like a good idea at the time. It explains why Stephen King signed a one-sided contract without the benefit of agent representation. One of the clauses involving subsidiary rights gave the publisher 50% of the proceeds on a paperback sale. Never having had that much money in their lives, the Kings welcomed the $200,000. But back in those days, when a literary agent sold the writer's work, he or she got 10% of the proceeds. So why should the publisher, doing the same job for the author, get paid five times as much? At the time, did it even cross King's mind? Agency representation would have been the wisest move he could have made. King could have asked his editor for a recommended literary agent or found one himself. And with a contract in hand from Doubleday ready to be negotiated, King would have had no problem finding a reputable agent to take him on as a client. At the time, it was a non-issue because King had other concerns. He was writing and publishing his short fiction and writing more novels. Simultaneously, his publisher became actively involved in promoting and positioning him, building and billing him as the King of Horror, a title King realized was good for marketing, but not so good for his literary reputation. Once a boogeyman, always a boogeyman. In the 5 years spanning 1973 to 1978, King's main novels, Carrie, Salem's Lot, The Shining, and The Stand, and a collection of short fiction, Night Shift, firmly cemented him as a horror writer. Had King never published anything else in his life, his fortune and reputation would forever be secure. Those four novels became classics, and all four would be adapted into movies for the silver screen or for television. Carrie saw multiple adaptations, and The Shining would also see King's own version, after the famous Kubrick version, which he disavowed. Even Night Shift, a collection of stories from Cavalier, shined. Many of the stories were adapted for motion pictures, including Trucks, which was a major motion picture titled Maximum Overdrive, directed by King himself. As King pointed out in numerous interviews over the years, when signing copies of the book for fans, he'd write, "I hope you enjoy these one-reel movies." Had King begun publishing the non-horror novels first, the books later published under the pen name of Richard Bachman, his career might have gone down a different path. But, as he pointed out in a foreword to Night Shift, eventually the monsters would have come out. Whether King is writing about monsters, the human or the inhuman kind, he's always focused on the people. As readers, once we're invested with the people in the story, we're interested and concerned about their fictional lives. It's all about the story, as John D. MacDonald wrote in his introduction to Night Shift, and King, also in Night Shift, reaffirms it. "All my life as a writer, I have been committed to the idea that in fiction, the story value holds dominance over every other facet of the writer's craft. Characterization, theme, mood, none of those things is anything if the story is dull. And if the story does hold you, all else can be forgiven." Paperback Writer. Carrie is a straightforward story about Carrie White, a high school student who's the butt of everyone's jokes. She reaches her breaking point after she's set up for a final humiliation that triggers her latent telekinetic power, with devastating consequences. 409 people in Chamberlain are killed, and 49 are missing in the wake of her destructive path. At its dark heart, Carrie is a horror story. But there's more to the novel than simply being a frightening tale. The book is really about high school hell, about the outsider who stands inside a glass dome through which she can see the rest of the world, one in which she will never be accepted. It's the horror of loneliness, of not being accepted, of being different, and the hell of not being able to do anything about it. High school is 4 years of misery for the ones who, for whatever reasons, don't fit in, like Carrie. Graffiti scratched on a desk of the Barker Street Grammar School in Chamberlain. Carrie White eats shit. In Harlan Ellison's Watching, a film review column for the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, he wrote about Carrie, explaining its popularity and enduring appeal. That first scene bit hard. It was the essence of the secret of Stephen King's phenomenal success, the everyday experience raised to the mythic level by the application of fantasy to a potent cultural trope. It was Jungian archetype goosed with 10 million volts of emotional power. It was the commonly shared horrible memory of half the population reinterpreted. It was the flash of recognition, the miracle of that rare instant in which readers dulled by years of reading artful lies felt their skins stretched tight by an encounter with artful truth. Stephen King, in one apocryphal image, had taken control of his destiny. The movie Carrie, directed by Brian De Palma, was released 2 years after the hardback book was published. Starring Sissy Spacek in the title role and Piper Laurie as her religion-obsessed mother, both were nominated but neither won Academy Awards for their stellar performances. Grossing more than $33.8 million domestically at the box office, Carrie helped carry King's name to monstrous heights. As King himself observed, "I made Carrie, and Carrie made me." Carrie, a $5.95 hardback, sold a modest 13,000 copies. But New American Library's $1.50 paperback edition, published in April 1975, blew out of the stores with over 1 million copies sold. As King explained in On Becoming a Brand Name, the publishers must orchestrate book releases so that they work in tandem. The writer produces a series of books which ricochet back and forth between hardcover and softcover at an ever-increasing speed. When the kinetic energy reaches critical mass, then boom, the writer becomes a brand name, which is what happened to King. Carrie the Movie, released on November 3, 1976, helped bring a large mainstream audience into King's camp. These were not book readers, but moviegoers, teenage boys with their dates who would scream their heads off and clutch their boyfriends in dark theaters. The perfect date movie, insofar as boys were concerned. The iconic image of a bucket filled with pig's blood is now an indelible part of the pop culture landscape, just like Carrie. Mention her name, and anyone will make the connection. Yeah, she's the girl in the Stephen King movie who had pig's blood dumped on her. Glad it wasn't me. For millions of young girls who feel victimized like Carrie, the book and the movie struck deep, responsive chords. They may not have been set up as she had been, or had pig's blood dumped on them, but they had been dumped on in other ways in junior high school or high school, and empathized with Carrie's tragic situation, which triggered her cataclysmic rage and claimed hundreds of lives, including hers. A timeless story of bullying, Carrie will forever live on. There was a film sequel in 1999, The Rage, Carrie 2, a made-for-TV film in 2002, an ill-fated musical on Broadway on which the critics dumped the equivalent of pig's blood in their reviews, and yet another theatrical release in 2013 starring Chloe Grace Moretz in the title role. But none of those could hold a candle to the original movie, and fans and purists who want to see a faithful adaptation of the book are advised to seek the 1976 film, though its grave ending was, to my mind, a bit of an overreach. But then, you gotta hand it to De Palma. He knew exactly what he was doing. Michael Collings, the first major critic who wrote about King's work in a book series for Starmont House, wrote in The Films of Stephen King that, as a film translation of King's prose, Carrie ranks among the best. Since the novel was itself spare and concise, the film comes closer to the major narrative threads. The documentary sense of the novel helps the film in determining and developing characters, while the casting led to strong and believable characters. Stacey Spacek as Carrie and Piper Laurie as Carrie's mother do not physically resemble King's Carrie and Margaret White, but bring an intensity to their roles that penetrates beneath the physical and recreates the psychological. As the first film of a King novel, Carrie brought King to public awareness. De Palma made the film, King once commented, and the film made him. After the appearance of Carrie, Stephen King was well on his way to becoming a household name in horror. Years later, in a book review for Stephen King Companion, 1995, Collings wrote, "Rereading it after 20 years, and with the experience of the intervening 40-odd novels and collections, dozens of short stories, decades of film versions, and constant streams of imitators and parodists, it may be rather surprising to see how well the novel holds up, particularly since it's a first novel. Carrie is a precise, focused, controlled exercise in narrative. As compelling for its story as for its brutal images of death and wholesale destruction and its examination of wild-card psychic talents as metaphors and symbols for things deeply wrong with American society and life. In its stark portrayal of the bleakness, the terror, the emptiness of the life of an adolescent outsider, it is difficult to surpass." And given the fact that one of King's primary audiences consists of precisely that age group that the novel anatomizes and in part pillories, that is, high school students, it is almost perfect in its ambitions and its effects. It presents the world of its characters and of a large group of its readers with clarity, skill, and appropriate brutality. against the crispness of a real world. He juxtaposes the dark places that lie beneath the intellect, beneath reason and logic, beneath coherence and motivation and probability. These are the areas King has taken for his own and begins to map in Carrie. 18. Campus Columnist Publishes Novel by Burton Hatlin. The first major serious review of Carrie appeared in Alumnus, spring 1974, a publication of the University of Maine at Orno. Written by one of King's college professors, the review takes King and his work seriously. It's a full-page review, from which I'm quoting the most relevant paragraphs that discuss King's student days. King's exploration not of the American dream, but the American nightmare, and Carrie as the outsider. Burton Hatlin, who ends his review with a prescient observation, should be noted as being the first to do so in print. Carrie is the first published novel by Stephen King, a 1970 UMO graduate. Steve will be remembered by some readers of the campus as the author of a notorious column called The Garbage Truck. During the hectic years of campus radicalism, Steve was one of the most radical of them all, in hair length and in lifestyle at least. Even then, he was committed to a career as a writer, and in the quiet moments between the strikes and demonstrations, he worked at developing his skills as a novelist. When I met him as a sophomore, he had completed two novels. By my count, Carrie is not his first novel, but his sixth. So if the $200,000 he has received for paperback rights to Carrie looks like easy money, remember, this guy developed his talents by sheer hard work. However, when we turn from Steve's life to his book, we find not the American dream, but the American nightmare. Steve seems to have learned early what it feels like to be the outsider at the orgy of American affluence. His sympathies are always with Lazarus, crouched at the rich man's gate. He knows, too, how many Lazaruses there are in America, not only the blacks and the Indians and the Chicanos, but also the poor white living on the back roads of rural Maine. These people, the mill workers, the pulpwood cutters, the service station attendants, are Steve's people. Like them, he dreams of wealth. "The first thing I'll do when I sell a novel," he once told me, "is buy a purple Cadillac convertible with a tape deck and quadraphonic sound." But he also knows the desolation of rural Maine. The dreams gone sour, the bodies and souls twisted by lives of deprivation. And he knows the emotion which rules these lives is neither envy nor longing, but hate. A hate which, if it is ever unleashed, will bring down all the dream castles crashing down on our heads. Carrie, the central character, is a classic outsider. She is a chunky girl with pimples on her neck and back and buttocks. A frog among swans. The symbolic pattern emerges in the first two pages of the novel. Carrie is the sacrificial goat. She has been appointed by the community to serve as the scapegoat, the one that everyone picks on. As we watch this born loser, we gain a horrifying vision of how our society demands losers, victims, and outsiders, scapegoats. If there were no losers, how could there be any winners? Few of our writers have such a clear sense of the demons that lurk within the American psyche. And if Steve's ability to project this vision continues to develop, he has every promise of becoming a major American writer. Stephen King, American Gothic. It also seems to me important to recognize that Steve is writing within a distinctly New England literary tradition. There is some deep affinity between our dark woods and the Gothic mode in fiction. As a student, Steve was addicted to the Dark Shadows television series, a Gothic soap opera set in a crumbling mansion on the Maine coast. One of his favorite writers, even in his student days, was Shirley Jackson, who lived and wrote in Vermont and whose The Haunting of Hill House remains, to my mind, the most chilling of all American Gothic novels. Another favorite of his student days was H.P. Lovecraft, who was based in Providence, Rhode Island, and who evoked a haunted landscape of rural New England. And then there's the Gothic granddaddy of them all, Nathaniel Hawthorne. Burton Hatlin, from joshuamaine.com, inactive. 19. Salem's Lot, 1975, original title, Second Coming. The town knew about darkness. The town cares for devil's work no more than it cares for God's or man's. It knew darkness, and darkness was enough. Stephen King, Salem's Lot. Second Coming. In Different Seasons, a collection of four novellas that by consensus are Stephen King's best, King's afterword sheds light on what he would publish after Carrie. He had submitted two novels. The first was a suspense novel titled Blaze, which he described as a melodrama about a huge, almost retarded criminal who kidnaps a baby, planning to ransom it back to the child's rich parents, and then falls in love with the child instead. The second, titled Second Coming, which he described as a melodrama about vampires taking over a small town in Maine. As King tells it, he and Bill Thompson were standing on a street corner in New York, and Bill had to decide which book to publish. Bill voted for Second Coming, which was also King's choice. But the discussion brought up a growing concern of Bill's that King was going to be typed as a horror writer. "I don't want there to be a time when I think that Steve King should be exclusively a horror writer," King told the New York Times, September 1981. The temptation is great, though. You say to yourself, if I don't produce horror stories, I won't have any more number ones. And it's very satisfying to have number ones. Years later, though, King's horror affiliation would come back to haunt him when he sought to cross the bridge over from popular fiction to literature. Critics of his work made no bones about their contempt for King's body of work. Insofar as they were concerned, he was simply a popular novelist with literary pretensions, whose work was summarily dismissed. Nonetheless, Thompson and King made the right call. Second Coming, which would be published as Salem's Lot, was the better choice, because it's an imaginative retelling of the vampire myth in a small Maine town, where the old-world vampire could draw new blood without arousing suspicion, until it was too late. By then, a goodly number of the townsfolk would be infected, becoming vampires themselves, looking for more victims to feed upon, the vicious cycle continuing. Blaze. Blaze, on the other hand, was a crime suspense novel, and at odds with Carrie, which, if published second, would have had horror fans scratching their heads and wondering why he didn't write another horror novel, which was what they wanted and expected. Blaze eventually saw publication under King's pen name, Richard Bachman, in 2007. In its foreword, King wrote that when he went looking for the manuscript, with an eye toward republishing it with Hard Case Books, he couldn't find it and had no idea where the original manuscript was. "I'm surprised he didn't make a phone call to the Special Collections Department at the University of Maine at Orno's Library, which would have cleared up the mystery, because it's been listed in their card catalog since 1988, which I consulted before sitting down and reading the manuscript of Blaze, along with The Aftermath and Sword in the Darkness. I wrote about all three in the 1989 edition of The Stephen King Companion. The manuscript of Blaze is 173 double-spaced pages with 20 chapters, totaling approximately 50,000 words. There was also a partial rewrite of 106 double-spaced pages. The first draft, it should be noted, had editorial suggestions. I'm of the mind that the suggestions were by Thompson, who read the manuscript with an eye toward publishing it, as discussed in King's afterword to different seasons. The manuscript's dedication page read, "This is for my mother, Ruth Pillsbury King." When eventually published in 2007, the book's dedication was "For Tommy and Lori Spruce, and thinking of James T. Farrell." The Spruces are part of Tabitha's family tree, and James Thomas Farrell was a novelist best known for his Studs Lonergan trilogy. Salem's Lot. King's fans who enjoyed Carrie may have been surprised when they saw the length of Salem's Lot, but they shouldn't have been. Not if they had known about King's history. As Burton Hatlin pointed out in his review of Carrie, by his count, it was preceded by five other novels. Excluding the Juvenilia, The Aftermath, King's then unpublished novels included Sword in the Darkness, still unpublished and likely to remain so, and four novels eventually published under the Richard Bachman pen name, Getting It On, published as Rage in 1977, The Long Walk, published in 1979, The Running Man, published in 1982, and Blaze, published in 2007. If Carrie can be considered a simple meal, then Salem's Lot is a Thanksgiving feast with all the trimmings. The story behind the story, recalled King, goes back to a conversation he, Tabitha, and Chris Chesley discussed at the kitchen table in their trailer at Herman, Maine. King writes about it in detail in his essay, On Becoming a Brand Name. As he explained, "There are so many small towns in Maine, towns which remain so isolated that almost anything could happen there. People could drop out of sight, disappear, perhaps even come back as the living dead. I began to turn the idea over in my mind, and it began to coalesce into a possible novel. I thought it would make a good one if I could create a fictional town with enough prosaic reality about it to offset the comic book menace of a bunch of vampires. The key, King thought, was to follow Bram Stoker's device of keeping the vampire off stage. Stoker, wrote King in his nonfiction examination of the field in Danse Macabre, creates his fearsome, immortal monster much the way a child can create the shadow of a giant rabbit on the wall, simply by wiggling his fingers in front of a light. King is correct in thinking that, in the wrong hands, vampires can be cartoony caricatures, but in the right hands, their malevolent evil will strike fear, as it should, in any reader's heart. Though numerous horror films over the years have featured Dracula, and the vampire himself has become a staple in pop culture, the breakfast cereal Count Chocula and his pal Frankenberry come to mind. Stoker's Dracula inspired Anne Rice's seminal novel about Lestat, Interview with the Vampire, 1976, with its many sequels, including 2014's Prince Lestat. It also inspired George R.R. Martin to write Fever Dream, 1982, a darkly erotic atmospheric novel set in the Louisiana Bayou, and redolent of decadence and the ennui of near-immortal vampires that live only to feed upon humans, whom they term cattle. Just as Richard Matheson brought horror home in I Am Legend, King transplanted vampires to rural Maine to great effect. Clearly more in tune with a Grimm's fairy tale instead of one reimagined by Disney, King's vampire story bites deep. There is hidden evil among some of the small town's residents, who harbor their own dark secrets, and there is external evil in the form of the vampire, Barlow, and his faithful servant, R.T. Straker, who has long fingers, sunken eye sockets, and a bald pate. In an introduction to the Stephen King Collector's Edition of Salem's Lot, 1991, Clive Barker explains that the story of Salem's Lot and its battle to survive the evil that comes to nest in its midst is, it seems to me, one of the finest examples of Mr. King's extraordinary storytelling talents, and is likely to remain both popular and persuasive for many years to come. Clive called that one right. Whether or not the vampire is drawn to Jerusalem's lot, or whether the town drew the vampire, is immaterial. The fact is, the classic vampire has come to small town Maine to feed, though the town is already sickened from within. As Barker explains, it is not, finally, the vampires that kill Salem's Lot, but rather a corruption in the town itself, or more correctly, in its people. A number of little sins that allow the greater villainy it holds upon the town's soul. Perhaps it's this, more than any other element, which so distinguishes the book for me. The sense that Salem's Lot is complicit, by dint of its apathy and obtuseness, in its own destruction. The novel, after all, is not named after the vampire, but after the meat upon which the vampire feasts. The evil, Barker suggests, and King reaffirms in interviews about the book, is free-floating and will find residence elsewhere. There can be no blithely happy ending, though there is a purifying conflagration. It, too, is a devourer, and in the act of cleansing the town, it will also destroy it. Salem's Lot is eradicated, along with Barlow. But while the town will never be recreated, the legendary evil will reappear. If not in the next town, then in the next state. If not this year, then the one after. And the form it takes will be much like the form that perished in the Marston House. Salem's Lot was adapted for the visual medium as a television movie in 1979, and again in 2004. The first version was directed by Toby Hooper, who hewed closely to the original novel. It is regarded as far superior to the second, directed by Michael Salomon, which is based on a screenplay that took far too many liberties with major plot points and characters. Given that Hollywood periodically revisits King's major books with new versions, we may yet see a major motion picture of King's classic vampire tale. But in the interim, Hooper's TV version still satisfies. It is a solid, honest piece of work, even with the limitations inherent in bringing the novel to television. Of Hooper's version, King has said in an interview conducted by Paul Gagné in 1980 in Famous Monsters of Filmland, "Let me sum up by saying that when I first learned the book was being done for television rather than as a theatrical release, I was very disappointed. Television does tend to take quite a bit out of a story to avoid the risk of offending the average viewer. But that initial disappointment did not extend to the finished product. It was done for television, but it was done well for television. It's funny because most of the reviewers I've talked to since the thing was shown on TV seemed to be expecting me to really come out against it, but I just didn't feel that way. Sure, it probably would have been better if it wasn't done for television, but I'm certainly not going to run around screaming, 'They wrecked my fucking book!' I have a lot of respect for Richard Kobritz, producer, Toby Hooper, director, and the Salem's Lot production crew, because they made what is definitely one of the best horror films that has ever been made for television. As with Carrie, Salem's Lot sold to New American Library for a princely sum, $500,000, of which King got, again, half the proceeds. With two supernatural novels attached to his name, King knew that he was a brand name in the making, a realization shared by his publishers, who were happy to find a convenient marketing hook on which to hang his work. Horror was big in those days, King recalled in On Becoming a Brand Name. And I showed no signs with my second book of exchanging my fright wig and Lon Chaney makeup for a pipe and tweed jacket and writing something deep and meaningful. In Horror, 100 Best Books, 1988, novelist Al Sarantonio was clearly bitten, if not smitten, by Salem's Lot. While Rosemary's Baby and The Exorcist mined supernatural niches in the bestseller list, I would argue that Salem's Lot, because of its genuineness, its verve, its originality, its willingness to reflect, expand, and celebrate its sources, and most importantly, its establishment of Stephen King, after the sincere but unseminal Carey, not as an interloper, but as a pioneer in a field ripe for reinvention, was germinal and originative of the entire boom in horror fiction we find ourselves in the middle of, with no culmination in sight. Of course, a bust always follows a boom, which is what inevitably happened. Michael Collings, writing in The Stephen King Companion, 1995, observed that Salem's Lot stands today as one of the finest treatments of the traditional vampire since Bram Stoker's Dracula, 1897, and one of the last serious treatments of the mythos surrounding the vampire that has developed over the course of the preceding century. In a period when vampire lore was already moving from a source of horror to fodder for parody, and when most conventional vampire stories looked to the past not only for inspiration, but also for settings and characters, Salem's Lot infuses vitality into a tired tradition while simultaneously attempting to recreate in a contemporary American idiom the atmosphere of evil that characterizes Stoker's Dracula. Just as Stoker's tale of the walking undead was set in then-contemporary late Victorian England, so King's tale unfolds in a small New England American community, at once typical and unique. Salem's Lot, which remains one of King's favorites among his works, demonstrates his ability to write complex, multi-leveled narratives, to create extraordinary but ultimately believable, memorable characters, to make full use of his increasingly symbolic landscape, eventually building from the rough blueprints for the lot his own private landscape for horror in Castle Rock and its haunted environs, and to write fictions that, while making full use of horror motifs, nonetheless touch readers on levels transcending mere horror. On Salem's Lot as the Great American Novel. Oh, man. I hope it would be the Great American Novel. But you know what this is. The idea of the Great American Novel. It's like when you're driving on the interstate and it's a hot summer day and on the horizon you see this quicksilver. It looks like a puddle and you get up to where it was, but you can just see it farther on. Nobody's ever going to write the Great American Novel. What you do is stand out there, or you try to maintain integrity, whatever that is. You try not to say the cheap thing and the easy thing. You have to ask yourself, do you have the intellect? And if you have the intellect, do you have the talent to support an idea for the Great American Novel? You can't answer it. All you can do is do the best you can. Stephen King, Penobscot Review, 1977. Stephen King and Frank Darabont on Limited Edition Books, 2007. Stephen King, in an interview with Hans Oke Lia from Lia's Library, The World of Stephen King, 2009. Frank Darabont is really high on the idea of doing a limited edition of The Mist. I don't like them. I think they are books for rich people and they're elitist and the whole idea of limiteds, there's something wrong with it, you know? The idea that people want a book that they can kind of drool over or masturbate on. I don't know what it is they want with these things, but it's like they get this book and it's this beautiful thing and they go like, don't touch it, don't, oh God, it's worth $1,000, he signed it. And all this. And my idea of a book that I like is when someone comes up to me at an autographing and you got this old beat to shit copy of The Stand and they say, I'm sorry it looks this way. And I say, I'm not. It means a lot of people have read it and enjoyed it. Frank Darabont, in an interview with Hans Oke Lia from Lia's Library, The World of Stephen King, 2009. When I read your interview with Stephen King, I had to laugh when I read his comments about limited edition books. I laughed because he and I have had this debate many times. It is a loving debate, as only friends can have. After I read the interview, I sent him an email that said, "Steve, contrary to your notion that people who buy limiteds never read them, I've read every single one of mine, some of them more than once. I had the gigantic Salem's Lot Limited from Centipede Press, all 20 pounds of it, resting on my stomach for 3 nights in a row as I lay in bed. Not only did I enjoy every word of it, but it also strengthened my stomach muscles. And last year I reread that gorgeous The Stand Limited Edition published some 15 years ago that looked like the Bible and came in a wooden box. That The Stand Limited was actually a gift to me from Steve, which was incredibly generous of him." I went on to tell him, "I agree, it's absurd to put a book on a shelf and never touch it, as if it were some holy relic instead of a book. That's like being afraid to open a bottle of wine because it's too expensive and rare, or afraid to drive a classic car for the same reason. Wine is meant to be drunk. Books are meant to be read. Classic cars are meant to be driven. And I do all three." He responded by suggesting that I refrain from doing all three at the same time. As I've told Steve in the past, I really feel that presenting a beloved book as a limited edition is a way to honor that literary work and the author responsible for it. The people who create these limiteds do so because they love the book. It shows in the care and quality and effort they put into creating them. I feel it's a huge compliment to the book and its author. I became email friends with Jared Walters, who runs Centipede Press, because I was so knocked out by that awesome huge Salem's Lot he published. So I got in touch to compliment him on it. I sent him a fan letter. And it was very clear to me as we emailed back and forth that he published that limited for one very compelling reason. Jared read Salem's Lot when he was younger, and it changed his life. He loves that book so much that he wanted to honor it, make something special of it, like putting a painting in a perfect frame and hanging it on a wall with just the right lighting. As for people who buy these books, like me, they do so for the same reason. We love the book. I certainly wouldn't buy a limited of a book I didn't care for just as an investment or some other silly reason. But for a book I love, how wonderful to have a special edition of it. I've told Steve that as long as the books are also available in low-cost trade editions, books for the people, as Steve admirably calls them, then what harm is there in doing a small number of special editions for loony, hardcore book lovers like me? It is the difference between buying a gorgeous, custom-made chair lovingly handmade by an artisan who withholds no effort in crafting it, and buying a cheap, mass-produced chair at IKEA. You can sit on both. They serve the same function, but the aesthetic of the handcrafted chair makes it a piece of art in itself. 20. The Shining. 1977. Original titles, Darkshine, The Shine. After 27 years of seeing little of the United States except the confines of Maine, Stephen King decided it was time for a change of scenery. Randomly pointing a finger at a map, his finger landed on Colorado, and the family packed up to move to Boulder, a town northwest of Denver, located at the eastern foothills of the Rocky Mountains. Living in a rented house at 330 South 42nd Street, King began work on a novel with the working title of The House on Value Street, which proved to have no value. After 6 weeks of attacking it and getting nowhere, King reluctantly abandoned it. Instead, he picked up another idea, inspired by a Ray Bradbury story, The Veldt, originally published as The World the Children Made, which had been published in the Saturday Evening Post, 1950. A cautionary tale about how immersion in a telepathically controlled virtual reality can replace the real world, two children become fixated on a scene of the African Veldt that overrides everything else, to the point that the family psychologist suggests weaning the kids away by shutting it down. But the addicted kids lure their parents to the Veldt, where they're devoured by lions. King liked the idea of a child's mind acting as a psychic receptor. I wanted to take a little kid with his family and put them someplace, cut off, where spooky things would happen, he told attendees at a talk in Pasadena, California. Darkshine, set in an amusement park, proved to be unworkable. The thing is, King told the audience, you can't really cut a family off in an amusement park. They'll go next door and say, we've got some problems here. King, though, liked the idea, but knew it required more thinking, and decided a vacation might be the answer. On the advisement of locals who suggested a resort hotel located in Estes Park, an hour's drive away to the north, Stephen and Tabitha King found themselves checking in at the Stanley Hotel just as its other guests were checking out, because the hotel was shutting down for the winter season. After checking in, and after Tabitha went to bed, King roamed the halls and went down to the hotel bar, where drinks were served by a bartender named Grady. As he returned to his room, numbered 217, his imagination was fired up by the hotel's remote location, its grand size, and its eerie desolation. And when King went into the bathroom and pulled back the pink curtain for the tub, which had claw feet, he thought, what if somebody died here? At that moment, I knew that I had a book. Salvaging the best parts of Darkshine, King began writing The Shine, a reference to the paranormal powers of Danny Torrance, whose father would become the winter caretaker of the Overlook Hotel, with disastrous results. Deliberately structured like a five-act play, the novel was a modern-day Shakespearean tragedy. It even had a lengthy prologue, before the play, which was cut from the novel due to length considerations, though it saw print in a special Stephen King issue of Whispers, a semi-pro magazine published and edited by Stuart David Schiff. It was subsequently reprinted in TV Guide, 1997, with illustrations commissioned by horror artist Bernie Wrightson. The original epilogue was also reworked and incorporated into the last chapter. With the passage of 37 years, The Shining has lost none of its considerable power as a narrative. Considered by college professors as King's best and most teachable novel because of its psychological complexity, Michael Collings explains, The Shining also represents one of King's few narrative excursions beyond New England. To this extent, his story of greed, moral corruption, and haunting fear represents a transfer of the darker elements of King's New England, and Hawthorne's and Poe's and Lovecraft's, to a newly opened West. King amplifies this sense of transplanted literary heritage with multiple allusions to mainstream writers, Frank Norris, Shirley Jackson, and others, horror writers. It is also impossible to read the novel without recalling again and again Poe's The Mask of the Red Death, or missing offhand allusions to Ray Bradbury. Modern dramatists. The novel is structured like a five-act play, with its own prologue in the separately published original introduction before the play, and others. In fact, The Shining is one of King's most teachable novels, simply because in it, he consciously incorporates so much of his own reading background, while at the same time using those references to create unique sequences of symbolic images. The Shining functions throughout on several levels, literal, symbolic, metaphorical, often with characters themselves pointing out the connections the readers should be making, as in Jack Torrance's elaborate meditations on the meaning of wasps. The novel provides a casebook example of literary nurturing, owing much of its power to King's articulate manipulation of others' words and images in the process of creating his own. This is not to suggest that The Shining is limited by its literary connections. On the contrary, here, King demonstrates an unusual skill in controlling outside references, in matching his style to meet the needs both of his story and of his literary texture. The Shining is the second of King's Big Three. Three novels completed during his first decade as a published novelist that, to this day, still largely define his role in American letters, and that provide an internal standard against which almost all of his subsequent books have been judged. Salem's Lot, The Shining, and The Stand. In other words, The Shining is an enduring classic. King friend and literary collaborator Peter Straub, in Horror, 100 Best Books, wrote, "I can't think of another book in the field of horror that affected me as strongly, and of only very few outside it. In its uniting of an almost bruising literary power, a deep sensitivity to individual experience, and its operatic convictions, it is a very significant work of art." In the hands of a hack novelist, The Shining would have been an eminently forgettable book. But King realized that in order to terrify, to fulfill the highest level of art in a horror novel, he would have to create fully rounded characters that aroused the reader's empathy. Jack Torrance, the protagonist of the novel, rings true because he's a down-on-his-luck guy at the end of his fraying rope, which is already unraveling. In an essay, On the Shining, King wrote, "I saw a face that hypnotized me because it was, to a large extent, my own. The book became a ritual burning of hate and pain, and in the actual writing, done in a quiet, rented room overlooking the Flatiron Mountains, I found myself mesmerized by the story." Recalling the days not too long before that when King also found himself at the end of his fraying rope, he was